At 1 a.m. the night nurse looked in. He pretended to be asleep. When she closed the door, he arduously sat up and swung his legs over the side of the bed. He sat still for a while, testing his sense of balance. Then he cautiously put his left foot down on the floor. Luckily, the axe blow had struck his already crippled right leg. He reached for his prosthesis, stored in the cabinet next to his bed, and attached it to his stump. Then he stood up, keeping his weight on his uninjured leg. As he shifted his weight, a sharp pain shot through his right leg. He gritted his teeth and took a step. He would need crutches, and he was sure that the hospital would offer him some soon. He braced himself against the wall and limped over to the door. It took him several minutes, and he had to stop after each step to deal with the pain. He rested on one leg as he pushed open the door a crack and peered out into the corridor. He did not see anyone, so he stuck his head out a little farther. He heard faint voices to the left and turned to look. The night nurses were at their station about 20 yards down on the other side of the corridor. He turned his head to the right and saw the exit at the other end. Earlier in the day he had inquired about Lisbeth Salander's condition. It was, after all, her father. The nurses obviously had been instructed not to discuss other patients. One nurse had merely said in a neutral tone that her condition was stable, but she had unconsciously glanced to her left. In one of the rooms between his own and the exit was Lisbeth Salander. He carefully closed the door, limped back to the bed and detached his prosthesis. He was drenched in sweat when he finally slipped under the covers. Inspector Holmberg returned to Stockholm at lunchtime on Sunday. He was hungry and exhausted. He took the Tunnelbana to City Hall, walked to police headquarters on Bergsgarten, and went up to Inspector Bublansky's office. Modig and Anderson had already arrived. Bublansky had called the meeting on Sunday because he knew that preliminary investigation leader Richard Ekström was busy elsewhere.
"Thanks for coming in," said Bublansky. "I think it's time we had a discussion in peace and quiet to try to make sense of this mess. Yerko, do you have anything new?"
"Nothing I haven't already told you on the phone. Zalachenko isn't budging an inch. He's innocent of everything and won't talk. Just that..."
"Yes?"
"Sonia, you were right. He's one of the nastiest people I've ever met. It might sound stupid to say that. Policemen aren't supposed to think in those terms. But there's something really scary beneath his calculating facade."
"Okay." Bublansky cleared his throat. "What have we got, Sonia?"
She smiled weakly. "The investigative reporter won this round. I can't find Zalachenko in any public registry, but a Carl Axel Bodin seems to have been born in 1942 in Uddevalla. His parents were Marianne and Georg Bodin. They died in an accident in 1946. Carl Axel Bodin was brought up by an uncle living in Norway, so there is no record of him until the 70s when he moved back to Sweden. Mikael Blomqvist's story that he's a GRU agent who defected from the Soviet Union seems impossible to verify, but I'm inclined to think he's right."
"And what does that mean?"
"The obvious explanation is that he was given a false identity. It must have been done with the consent of the authorities."
"You mean the security police, SEPO?"
"That's what Blomqvist claims. But exactly how it was done, I don't know. It presupposes that his birth certificate and a number of other documents were falsified and then slipped into our public records. I don't dare to comment on the legal ramifications of such an action. It probably depends on who made the decision. But for it to be legal, the decision would have to have been made at senior government level." Silence descended in Bublansky's office as the four criminal inspectors considered these implications.
"Okay," said Bublansky. "The four of us are just dumb police officers. If people in government are mixed up in this, I don't intend to interrogate them."
"Hmm," said Anderson. "This could lead to a constitutional crisis. In the United States, you can cross-examine members of the government in a normal court of law. In Sweden, you have to do it through a constitutional committee."
"But we could ask the boss," said Holmberg.
"Ask the boss?" said Bublansky.
"Thorbjörn Fälldin. He was Prime Minister at the time."
"So we'll just cruise up to wherever he lives and ask the former Prime Minister if he faked identity documents for a defecting Russian spy."
"I don't think so." "Fälldin lives in Ås, in Härnösand. I grew up a few miles from there. My father's a member of the Centre Party and knows Fälldin well. I've met him several times, both as a kid and as an adult. He's a very approachable person.
Three inspectors gave Holmberg an astonished look.
You know Feldin?
Bublansky said dubiously. Holmberg nodded. Bublansky pursed his lips.
To tell the truth, said Holmberg, it will solve a number of issues if we could get the former Prime Minister to give us a statement. At least we'd know where we stand in all this. I could go up there and talk to him. If he won't say anything, so be it. But if he does, we might save ourselves a lot of time.
Bublansky weighed the suggestion. Then he shook his head. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw that both Modig and Anderson were nodding thoughtfully.